Encourage you to have your Bible out this morning. We are going to spend a good amount of time in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel in our study, but we will start in 1 John chapter 2. So turn with me, if you would, to 1 John chapter 2. It's good to be with you this morning as we are able to worship God in spirit and in truth. If you've got any questions about anything that you hear, or anything that you observe while you're with us today, let us know. We'd be glad to have the opportunity to study with you and help you find Bible answers to the questions that you have. Let's get into our study in 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away in the lust of it, but he who does the will of God abides forever. Temptation comes to us primarily through these three avenues. Lust of the flesh, that is, we have desires that we want fulfilled. Lust of the eyes. We see something that we like and we want to go after that. We want to obtain that. And pride of life. How is this going to make me feel? It's going to make me better, or it's going to salve my wounded pride. Pride is another strong avenue of temptation. Now, the world appeals to us through these different avenues. As children of God, as Christians, We have to fight against this. We have to resist this. We have to practice self-control. And that's what I want to talk about this morning, self-control. Self-control. What is self-control? Self-control is the ability to hold ourselves in check and to tell ourselves no. When the world comes knocking, either through the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, or the pride of life, there's a part of us that responds positively to that. That is our flesh. Our flesh wants to sin. And the world says, why not? Do it. And so there is that conflict that's going on always between our flesh and our spirit. And it is our spirit that has to step up and has to be ready and willing to give an overwhelming no when the flesh is saying yes. When you go to the grocery store every once in a while, you'll see parents either pushing the cart or they've got little ones with them, and every once in a while the little one will want something and the parent has to say no. And all things being equal, there's a reason the parent says no. It is not in the child's best interest to have that at that time. And so the child needs someone to tell them no. Here's the thing about growing up. As we grow up, as we mature, as we enter into adulthood, and really well before then, we have to become the ones who tell ourselves no. And that can be difficult. That can be difficult to do, but we have to be able and willing to do this. As a matter of fact, the ability to restrain oneself is a sign of character and a sign of great strength. Proverbs 16, verse 32 says, he who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. What does that mean? That means the person who can control themselves and conquer and overcome themselves is mightier than the one that can level a city and take over a city. Another proverb, chapter 25, verse 28, a man without self-control is like a city broken into and left without walls. So self-control is the ability to say no, and we have to have that, but it's more than that. As we're considering this study today, it's more than just telling ourselves no and restraining ourselves from sinful desires. I also want to include in it the ability to avoid excess in lawful things. And that is to practice that word that a lot of us don't really like, moderation. Moderation, but that's a part of self-control, not overdoing it. It's okay to have a piece of caramel corn every once in a while. But when someone makes me a big bag of it, it's hard to stop. But sometimes that's where self-control comes in. Okay, that's enough of that. And by the way, I'm not asking for more caramel corn, by the way. But you get the idea that all of us struggle with different things like that where we need enough and we need to tell ourselves no. Also, self-control is the determination to do the difficult and seemingly impossible task. And so in this sense, it's when we have to tell ourselves, yes, you have to do this. Where we would, otherwise we'd say, no, I don't want anything to do with this, or later, we can take care of that later. Self-control is, no, we're going to take care of it now. We're going to do it now. I want to take all of these ideas and bring them together today as we're talking about self-control. Self-control, or the mastery of oneself, is never a completed task. None of us, as long as we are in this world, can say, all right, I've done it. I've mastered self. I've got self-control down pat. Let's move on to something else. No, every day there's going to be that battle. Every day the temptation is going to come through one of those three avenues, and every day we're going to have to fight the battle again. Sometimes we win, and sometimes we lose. King David is a great example of this ongoing battle with self-control. Our young people yesterday were involved in a get-together in which they looked at some different Bible characters. I wasn't able to attend that, but I want to continue that vein of that study by looking at King David. And I want to look at King David's battles with self-control. And I want to look at two times that he won. And then we're going to look at two times that he lost. So now we're going to go back to the book of 1 Samuel. We're in 1 Samuel chapter 24. And let's look at one of these victories. And that is when David spared Saul's life. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 24, verses 1 through 7. 1 Samuel chapter 24, verses 1 through 7. Now it happened when Saul had returned from following the Philistines that it was told him, saying, take note, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. So he came to the sheepfolds by the road where there was a cave, and Saul went in to attend to his needs. David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave. Then the men of David said to him, this is the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you. And David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. And he said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord. So David restrained his servants with these words and did not allow them to rise against Saul. And Saul got up from the cave and went on his way. So we're here looking at this passage. We know that David is on the run for his life. Saul has rebelled against God. A troubling spirit has taken over Saul, and he wants to kill David. David is the next in line for the king, and Saul is intent to do away with him, to kill him. So David has to flee. David has to take his men and go and live as refugees out in the wilderness in Israel, fleeing for their lives. There is, within the heart of most people, a proper understanding of fairness and justice. And there is a strong desire to get justice when we know that we have been wronged. David has the opportunity to do this. David and his men are fleeing for their life. They haven't done anything wrong. They're hiding in a cave. And who comes into that cave but the man who is responsible himself? Wanders right into that cave, and Saul's servants say, "Here he is. Strike him down, and we can all go home." They are appealing to David's pride. As a matter of fact, look here in verse 4. "This is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as seems good to you.'" This is in your hand. You get to take care of this. You get to be judge, jury, and executioner. Just step forward, take him out of the way. This has to be God's will. Otherwise, this wouldn't have presented itself. They are appealing to David's pride. Now, you and I, we don't have a bunch of servants who are hiding back with us to whisper in our ears to appeal to our pride. We usually play this role ourselves. And when we are injured or we are hurt, we have some pretty dark voices going through our heads sometimes, telling us, you know what, you need to strike back. You know what, you need to give as you have received in this matter. You need to strike, you need to get even. And what is that? That's an appeal, among other things. That's an appeal to pride. David restrained himself. And because of that, he was able to restrain his men. Remember, again, we're talking about self-control. The ability to say no. The ability to practice restraint. Well, David restrained his men in verse 7. But the only reason he was able to restrain his men is because he first restrained himself. He won that battle that day. And that was a good thing. That was a good thing. That was a difficult thing. I don't know that we would have done the same as David under those given circumstances. But David won that battle that day. Let's look at another occasion. We turn just one chapter. Chapter 25. This is when David spared Nabal's household. We won't take the time to read through this entire chapter. It is a great chapter. There's a lot of action going on here. But let's set the stage. Remember, David is out hiding. He and his men are hiding out in the woods, out in the forest. And on this occasion, they've been up by Mount Carmel, and they've had occasion to hide in some of the same areas that a man named Nabal has sent his flocks, the shepherds and the flocks out, to live. And David has protected those flocks. They need food. They're hungry. But they didn't take one of those lambs. Matter of fact, they protected them. They shielded them. And the shepherds even understood this. If you look down in verses 15 and 16, here is one of these shepherds, one of these servants of Nabal, telling Abigail, Nabal's wife, what had happened, said, "But the men were very good to us, and we were not hurt, nor did we miss anything as long as we accompanied them when we were in the fields. They were a wall to us both by night and day, all the time we were with them keeping the sheep." So David has been good to Nabal, and now it is a feast day, and David asks for Nabal to repay that kindness by giving David and his men some food. Let's read here in chapter 25, verse 5 says, "David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, 'Go up to Carmel, go to Nabal, and greet him in my name. And thus you shall say to him who lives in prosperity, peace be to you, peace to your house, and peace to all that you have. Now I've heard that you have shearers. Your shepherds were with us, and we did not hurt them, nor was there anything missing from them all the while they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever comes to your hand to your servants and to your son David.' So when David's young men came they spoke to Nabal according to all these words in the name of David and waited. Now, verse 10, notice how David's kindness is repaid. Then Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants nowadays who break away, each one from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shears and give it to men when I do not know where they are from?" Verse 12 is very telling. So David's young men turned on their heels and went back, and they came and told him all these words. Their reaction shows that they understood just exactly what Nabal meant, even if we don't understand it from the reading of the text. He's saying, "I'm not giving David anything, because David's a nobody. Who cares what you did for me? I'm not going to give anything to you." They turn on their heels, and they come back, and they tell David, and David is ready to go after these men. Verse 13, "Then David said to his men, 'Every man gird on his sword.' So every man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword, and about 400 men went with David, and 200 stayed with the supply." So here they come, they're going to go after Nabal, and they're going to kill Nabal, and it turns out they're going to kill all the men. Well, Abigail, Nabal's wife, is told about this. You know, as I'm reading through this text, I get the feeling this isn't the first time she's had to do this for her husband. This is familiar territory for her because Nabal, the name Nabal means fool. And apparently she's had to bail her husband out before. But she knows he's in trouble now. She knows about David. And so she gets food ready and she sends an envoy of food to intercept David. And then she hurries herself. And she finally greets David, and when she does, she bows down before him, and she speaks to him. Look at verse 26, chapter 25, and at verse 26. "Now therefore, my lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has held you back from coming to bloodshed and from," get this, "from avenging yourself with your own hand. Now then, let your enemies and those who seek harm for my lord be as Nabal. And now this present which your maidservant has brought to my lord, let it be given to the young men who follow my lord. Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant, for the Lord will certainly make for my lord an enduring house, because my lord fights the battles of the Lord, and evil is not found in you throughout your days." Now, Abigail is acting very carefully here, but what she is doing is she is trying to talk some reason into David. Because David is angry, and we know you get an emotional state like that. You're not thinking clearly. You're acting very impulsively. So she acts very quickly, very carefully to try to reason with David. And notice what she has said. She has said, "You've done good, and that you've not come to bloodshed to avenge yourself." Verse 26, "because," verse 28, "you fight the Lord's battles." This is not the Lord's battle. This is you avenging yourself. And if you proceed with this, you are going to have blood on your hands. And so it's good that you have stopped short of doing that. You know what? She got through to him. She got through to him and he calmed down. As a matter of fact, he says, "If you hadn't showed up, I would have killed every man in your household. There would be none left." So again, it's his pride. It's his wounded pride. But he practices self-control. Now, there are a couple of lessons that stand out to me in this chapter that I want to share with you. Important lessons about the battles that we have with self-control. Number one is the danger of wounded pride and the elusiveness of self-control. Because in the previous chapter, he had it. And now he doesn't. And you know what? The same thing can happen to you and to me. There can be one day that we can win a battle. There can be one day that we can have a temptation that comes upon us. And it's a very strong temptation, and we defeat it. We beat it. And we think, you know, we won. We've got this down, and the next day, what happens? Self-control is nowhere to be found. It's that elusive. And this account tells us of that, reminds us of that danger. Here's something else I see in this account. Sometimes we need help overcoming and winning our battles. Sometimes we need help with self-control. David's men in the previous chapter, they weren't any help at all. Rise up and kill him. But it was Abigail. It was Abigail who came and reasoned with David and helped him to see what it was that he was doing. And sometimes we need to listen to the friends that we have. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, Proverbs 27, verse 6 says. Sometimes it's hard to tell someone that you love, you know you're not thinking right. You know this isn't like you. You know you shouldn't do this. That's not an easy thing to say, and it's not an easy thing to hear. But we need to listen to it. We need to listen to it. Sometimes we need help winning our battles with self-control. And that's what our friends and our loved ones are for. So here are two battles that David won. He did great. And we learn from it. We make application to our lives. But there were other times that David lost. Let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 11. And yeah, we're going to talk about David and Bathsheba. We need to talk about that. 2 Samuel at chapter 11, verses 2 through 5. 2 Samuel 11, verses 2 through 5. Then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked on the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. So David sent and inquired about the woman. And someone said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Then David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her, for she was cleansed from her impurity, and she returned to her house. And the woman conceived, so she sent and told David and said, "I am with child." David saw something that he wasn't supposed to see. The sight of a beautiful woman bathing didn't excite his pride. It excited his eyes and his flesh. So here's David being appealed to through the other two avenues of temptation. He acted on this strong temptation and he committed the sin of adultery. Now, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13 tells us, "No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide a way of escape, that you may be able to bear it." One thing I want to share with you, because we've looked at David and Bathsheba before, but in preparing for this lesson, I saw David had plenty of opportunities to escape. And he didn't take them. Let's consider very quickly some of these opportunities for escape. Number one, he should have looked away. When he was standing on the roof of his house and he looked and he saw something that he shouldn't have seen, he should have looked away. Job earlier said, Job 31 verse 1, "I've made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman?" When that came into Job's view, he didn't look upon it. He'd already made that decision. Now, either young people and those of us who are not young, we can't always help what we see. We're not always in a maintained, wholesome environment like our homes. And sometimes even then, things slip through. But out in the world, we're going to see any number of things. So we've got to train ourselves that when we do, we simply look away. David could have done that, but he didn't. He should have gotten off the roof. Well, that's his roof. He had the right to be up there. And by the way, he wasn't standing on a peaked roof like many of our houses have. In Palestine, the roofs were primarily flat, and many people used them as an extra story of their house. So David being up on his roof wasn't an uncommon thing. But when he saw that it was a source of temptation, he should have gotten down. That's exactly what Joseph did. In Genesis 39, verses 11 and 12, but it happened at this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. David, when he saw what was going on, and he realized the impact it was having on him, he should have gotten out of there. But he didn't. That was another door of escape that he did not take. Third, David should have realized that she was off limits to him. What do I mean by that? Verse 3 says, so David sent and inquired about the woman, and someone said, now, I want to pause right there. Could you imagine? Here's a grown married man standing on his rooftop looking down at a woman, seeing something he shouldn't see, and he calls for other people to come and look with him. Oh, yeah, that's Bathsheba. That is the daughter of Eliam, one of your counselors. That is the wife, ding, 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 ding. That's the wife of Uriah the Hittite. When David heard that, that should have told him, she's off limits. Because she's somebody else's wife. I remember before Christy and I met, I was like a lot of young men. I'd like to find a bride. And whenever I would meet a young woman, And I would talk with her, and I'm getting to know her, I'd look at that left hand, and I'd look at that ring finger, and if there was a ring there, we're done. No. No, it wasn't that. But I knew, you know, we're not going to pursue this. That's off limits. That's off limits. And we need to understand that. If someone is married, they are off limits. And David should have gone to his own wife. Matter of fact, he had more than one. And he could have gone to his own wife to fulfill those desires. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 talks about that. Matter of fact, it uses our word self-control. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourself to fasting and prayer and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. This is a very dangerous temptation. Satan knows it. He uses it. God knows it. He warns us about it. And so one avenue of escape for him was to simply go to his wife. He didn't do any of these. When this visual caught David's attention and turned into a stare, he refused to act with reason. He refused to take the numerous ways of escape from the temptation, and he committed sin. He committed the sin of adultery, but then this sin was multiplied. Because to cover it up, which is another sin, he got Bathsheba's husband drunk, which is a sin. Getting a man drunk is a sin. And eventually he had him murdered, which obviously is a sin. So one sin led to another and led to another. Now the sin ultimately is forgiven. God comes to David through the prophet Nathan, exposes the sin, and David confesses. And one thing we do learn from David, when he fails these battles with self-control, the man after God's own heart teaches us not only, number one, that it's possible to lose these battles, but number two, he teaches us how to react when we do lose these battles. He confessed his sin, but there were severe consequences to the sin. It cost him dearly, and it cost the people around him dearly. And we need to learn from that as well. Listen to me, God's people. Young, old, married, single, I don't care. Listen to me. People pay dearly when one commits the sin of adultery. The sin of adultery is going to cause great trouble. It's going to cause incredible problems. And not just for you. It's going to cause problems for everybody. And we need to learn that from David. There are going to be times when we lose these battles of self-control, and sometimes when we lose, it only affects us. But other times when we lose, it affects a lot of people. That's why we need to take these battles seriously. And let's look, finally, at a second time that David lost. Turn to the very end of 2 Samuel chapter 24. This is the account of David numbering his nation, numbering his people. 2 Samuel chapter 24. Let's read verses 1 through 3. Again, the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel, and he moved David against them to say, "Go, number Israel and Judah." So the king said to Joab, the commander of the army who was with him, "Now go throughout all the tribes of Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, and count the people, that I may know the number of people." And Joab said to the king, "Now may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times more than they are, and may the eyes of my lord and king see it. But why does my lord and king desire this thing?" Interesting thing is happening here in this chapter. David wants the people of his kingdom numbered. Well, now, right off, we read that the Lord is aroused against Israel, and God is using this as a means of punishing Israel, but David's involved here. David is involved. He wants the people of the kingdom numbered. Joab, his chief commander, Joab questions this command. And likely, he's trying to reason with him. You know, have you thought this thing through? Are you really sure this is what you want to do? But unlike Abigail, Joab isn't able to awaken David to the mistake that he is making. It appears that David is trying to find out how large of an army he has. When you look down at verse 9, "Then Joab gave the sum of the number of the people to the king, and there were in Israel 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword, and the men of Judah were 500,000 men." What's the problem with knowing how big your army is? Well, the problem here is that God took offense at it, because God is the protector of Israel, not David, and not the size of his army. So once again, this is a matter of pride. David wants to see how big of an army he has at his disposal. It is a sin of pride. David isn't motivated by injustice here. He's in a comfortable position. He's falling victim to his pride. He fails to exercise self-control, he loses this battle, and he commits sin. Now, you and I may not be reigning as kings, and we may not have access to an army to command as our own, but we are still expected to trust God to protect us and to see us through in our daily lives. And when we overlook God's promises and we rely on ourselves as the only means of provision, we're showing a lack of faith in God, and we are opening the door to sin. David lost this battle, and God forgave him his sin. We read of that in the chapter. But once again, innocent people suffered because of David's lack of self-control. Verse 15 tells us 70,000 men died in this plague. People in positions of authority and influence are going to see similar consequences when they lose their battles with self-control. Think about national leaders. They have to struggle with self-control. Should I do this? Should I do that? Should I respond to this provocation in this way? And when they lose those battles, people in their nation suffer as a result. Maybe the CEO of a company, and he's wanting the company to grow and to be successful, and he decides, you know, to do this, we're going to cut some corners. We're going to cut some corners. We're not going to report these profits. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. Eventually, it's found out. What happens? He's not the only one who suffers. Shareholders suffer. Employees might get laid off, lose their job, because the company's going to lose profits. A lot of people suffer because of that. Let's come to the home. What about parents? What about when a father or a mother decides they're faced with temptation and they lose a battle with self-control, they decide that they're going to sin? Oftentimes their family pays a price. It affects their family. Maybe they turn to the bottle. Maybe they turn to gambling. Maybe it's something else. Their loved ones are going to suffer as a result. It can happen in the church as well. It can happen anywhere. So we need to learn from this that when we lose a battle with self-control, yes, it can be forgiven. Yes. But there are physical consequences that aren't just wiped away. We have to face those consequences, and oftentimes others have to face those consequences as well. And that should remind us that these battles are serious. And we need to take these battles seriously because other people pay when we lose these battles. Brethren, oftentimes the greatest enemy that we face is the enemy within. It's the flesh. It's the part that responds positively to the lust of the eyes and the lust of the flesh and the pride of life. And it's the spirit that desires to do the will of God that has to say no, and that battle is on. It's there every day. Well, our study today has reminded us that this battle has to be taken seriously. We need to listen to those who are trying to reason with us and tell us, don't do that. We need to have our hearts and our ears, our minds open to that. We need to take the way of escape when we are battling temptation. And we need to seek forgiveness when we lose a battle. And we need to fight again the next day. We need to serve the Lord faithfully. We've covered a lot of ground today, but it's been a great study, a lot of good lessons here, a lot of good applications in the area of self-control. We can control ourselves. We have to control ourselves. That's what God expects of us. We're going to offer the invitation at this time. It is the Lord's invitation that's extended to those who are not yet Christians. Maybe you need to obey the gospel. Maybe you need today to repent of your sin, confess your faith, and be baptized to have those sins washed away. You can let us know during this invitation song that that's your desire, and we'd be glad to help you with that. Maybe you need to make things right in a public way. Maybe you've lost one of these battles in a way that's brought reproach on the church, that people know about this, and you need to make it right in a public way. We'd be glad to help you with that. Or maybe you're overwhelmed and burdened, and you need our prayers. Whatever your spiritual need is, would you let it be made known by coming forward as we stand and sing this invitation song?